Boy, listen to that tech, noise reduction. Wowie zowie.
No.
Let's just talk industry for hours.
Oh my gosh,
let's
no.
Talk noise reduction.
Well, I'd rather talk that kind of industry. You know, there's the two kinds. There's engineering, which was my nerdy side. And
yes.
So, you know, it's nice to sprinkle a little bit of that in when you're speaking to like
Introduce yourself, please. They're going to be like, who is this person he's having a conversation with?
Oh, okay, so I am Julian Baker.
You look just like her.
Oh, you know, it takes a lot of work.
So, only child, we're going to get there for many reasons. Parents separated, that other little thing called Forrester, the church. So, I've now just done like all the categories, and we could be done with this interview now because I've covered pretty much, we're done. However, let's just go to today for 30 seconds because I was right over there watching you. And one of the things that you were quoted as saying is that you were nervous. You know, little you, big stage, you weren't nervous. You were in your element. You were ready.
No, I do get nervous. I think, and I was just talking about it curiously, so Lucy Dacus comes up again. But the one thing I'm fearful of being that we've both discussed is entitled or jaded. And I think a little, I don't want to ever assume that I deserve anything beyond just the human respect as an artist, but not that I'm like, in some way elevated above whoever's at my shows. I have no idea why. I have an SM58 and you're standing there. Our roles could easily be reversed. I don't know what's special about my story, but as long as you're listening, I'd like to be grateful for that. And so that imbues you with a little bit of like apprehension, right? So I'm aware of what a blessing it is that I'm on a huge stage and I don't know what I have done to get there or deserve it. And so it's a little bit of gratitude and, you know, positive apprehension. I think I would cease to be a good artist if I was like, yeah, that was great, I knocked it out of the park, and I never have felt like that.
So last Thanksgiving, my partner Debbie and I, who's sitting over there taking pictures notoriously, we were on our way to her relatives in Rhode Island. And I turned to her and I said, we're not going to Thanksgiving till I have a Dunkin' Donut. Now imagine this, Julian, this is Thanksgiving Day, and you're traveling from Boston to Rhode Island on a highway, and you see all these signs that say Dunkin' Donuts. We went to 4 Dunkin' Donuts, all closed. Don't you have enough gift cards from fans that you're never gonna pay for a Dunkin' Donut or the coffee in your life?
So you wanna know something insane is that people started giving me gift cards at the merch table, and I don't know how to take gifts because I'm like, look.
So you don't take those gift cards?
No, I do take the gift cards because I realize that it's the same thing as, it's more uncomfortable to deny a compliment. Say like, someone says, you did a great job.
That's so ecclesiastic of you.
Oh man, well, and I don't wanna be like, yes, I'm a martyr for taking these gift cards, which I'm not, but so, people give me the gift cards and I'm like, you already bought a shirt, you listen to my music, you bought the record, you bought a ticket, you sustain my life, you pay my bills, yet you felt the need to buy me a Dunkin' Donuts.
Give me coffee.
Yeah, so I'm like, how could I somehow recycle this? I mean, my coffee order is $2. People were giving me like $20 gift cards. So what I'd do is I'd get my coffee order, get coffee for the crew in the morning on me, or, and then
coffee for all my friends.
Coffee for all my friends. And then we, it was fun at the, we played a Bowery show. Me, right before I went and we got like a dozen donuts for like the first 12 people that showed up to the merch table. It was just like, dude, do you want a donut? Have them. Like, it makes me feel a little bit better, less slimy about taking the gift cards and using them for just me.
That's awesome. Okay, so we're going to enter this room an entirely different way. My daughter, Kate, is 15. She's an only child. I am an only child. But tell me a little bit about the family unit and how you found it since. I'm kind of curious about that.
Well, I think that's what I try to steer the conversation towards is from very early on. It's a conversation I'm perpetually having of constructing the narrative to not be... you made a comment about the no fun patch, which is just it's kind of an inside joke because the guy who drives us on all of these and does merch, he and I are both sober, and so it's just kind of a joke like, oh, we're no fun, we don't really party. But so it's not to say that we're no fun, but I think people want to get to the redemptive qualities of things, and so I try to say, like, look, I make sad songs because sad songs make me feel better. I make sad songs so that I can be a well-adjusted human because I get them out through that channel, and then that is what enables me to be chipper, goofy Julian. But I think what you're saying is, like, you've found all sorts of happiness, and I think you're mostly correct. There's this interesting distinction, I forgot who first made it to me, but between happiness and joy. Because, like, happiness, a temporary, transient emotion, and then joy is something that is not a feeling, but it's an attitude. It's like a choice based on priorities, perspective, being able to be content with what you have while being optimistic about what you do not. And I think that, like, whatever disparity of, you know, anything in my life has taught me to look for what is there, make the most of that, and use those gaps to, like, fill them in with something, you know. I think maybe we like the dark side, maybe not that we like it in a masochistic way, or that we want to indulge, because I think there is a difference between, like, wallowing and coping. So, like, coping is when you acknowledge that darkness is something that can be used as a tool or a jumping off point for self-analysis and self-improvement. But I think if you, one thing I also want to be careful not to do, sometimes people will ask very specific questions about, I think they want anecdotal descriptions of, one time I did this crazy thing or they want a story about a horrible instance that happened in my life, and I don't want to glamorize or elevate those things, because I'd rather say those were necessary stops on the train that was propelling me to here.
You talk about all this recent success being surprising. So again, I want to refocus that a little bit. I don't think that, I'm not saying that you didn't say that, but there's the surprise, and then there's the thankfulness that it actually is occurring. So, do you step back at any moment and look and go, wait a minute? You look over there and go, that's me. That's wow. How about that?
Like every day, every day. You know, I think it would be. I never assumed that anyone would care about the record enough, or that certain people would care about it, or that it would ever experience this kind of response. Even knowing that, like, in the scheme of things, I'm still, you know, this big compared to other artists, but it's afforded me experiences I never thought I would have in my wildest dreams. You know, when I used to be a kid, like, closing my eyes, imagining what it would be like to play stages like that, and then here I am doing it, and I think because we're raised in a culture where it's kind of like, yes, chase your dreams because you can be anything that you want to be, but you should have a backup plan. You should have a marketable skill. I mean, look at the removal of emphasis on the liberal arts in university settings and refocusing them on vocational skills. And so I had always, because I have a practical mind, said, that's fine. I will pursue this passion till my deathbed, and it'll probably be a hobby, and it'll probably be me pinching pennies.
It's a little more than a hobby.
Yeah.
I have to tell you this.
Well, it becomes a pipe dream because they say, oh, it's one in a million that you can pay your bills with music or art or writing, and then it happens to you.
Life is a problem to be solved. Not a problem to be solved, but a reality to be experienced. So you're taking a break from college, right? You were right at, like, how many credits did you have left?
Like a handful. Less than a full semester, because I was taking an overload at this time last year.
So do you think, as these people are watching, and doesn't matter, but these people are watching you up on stage and they're like, okay, she's the girl who's singing the bummer songs, and what's she gonna do with the rest of her life?
I think one thing I try to be aware of is that, what if? You know, what if I create the best record I possibly can, and I create art that I truly believe in, and it's not as well received? Then should I attach my... Another great Lucy Dacus nugget is, don't attach your worth to your work. Like, because if I make the very best thing I can do, if I say something that I believe is meaningful to me and I am honest, if it flops, then I'm just grateful that I got this tiny chunk of time, and if I have to return to being a school teacher or a barista or flipping burgers, I'll have these memories that no one can ever take away from me. And God, that's cliche, but like, I did not think half of this would happen to me. But you're right. I mean, and I think, unfortunately, I, man, it's interesting you choose that quote. It's true. Life is not a problem to be solved, but I approach it that way because I'm type A to a T.
Memphis, Christianity, choice of sexuality, telling her parents at 17. Duh! But I'm more interested. I don't think you're going to hell.
You don't think I'm going to hell?
I don't think you're going to hell.
I don't think I'm going to hell.
Okay, good. I just wanted to find this.
So I think you're getting at some really important things there, and it's kind of a twofold issue. But one thing that I've been recently talking about is that, a lot of people will focus on the fact that I grew up in the South, that I am a Christian, or, you know, I practice any faith at all. I mean, it's equally as taboo to be, say, a Muslim and a homosexual. Yes, I am a homosexual. And so people kind of make that into, like, a novelty.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, kind of employing the shock value there. And I'm like, so really what I would love to do is destigmatize it. I started attending an Episcopal church that was the only affirming church in the area in Murfreesboro. And I can't tell you how many gay Christians I've met. Like, there is an entire conference of gay Christians.
What a concept.
What a concept that you could be both and have that duality of thinking where it doesn't have to be one that's mutually, they're not mutually exclusive. It doesn't have to be one or the other, and that's something that I didn't know. But the reason why I'm so liberal about talking about it is that I would like other people to know it too, because I've had the fortune of, when I did come out to my parents at 17, it was all my greatest fears dispelled by their ability to overcome and say, we love you. We love our daughter, Julian. We don't think you're going to hell. In fact, we're going to sit here and convince you why you're not going to hell and why...
Right. They did a whole campaign.
Yeah, and I was like, oh my goodness, I didn't even know that people could respond this way. That's been my fortunate experience, but that's not true for everyone. You know, I recently was at a young writers camp in Tennessee, which was great. I got to hang out with some younger kids, just brilliant students. And this one girl came up to me and she was like, thanks for saying what you say, because I think there needs to be more representation of queer Christian youth. And I thought, oh my God, I didn't even realize, you know, there are kids who get thrown out of their homes, who get holy watered, who get attempted exorcisms, and that was never my experience, but it's real, and I want to validate their mere existence just by saying, yeah, you don't have to choose one or the other, you know, but...
And you're not alone by any stretch. The camaraderie of female artists that have now surrounded you...
Oh my gosh, I want to be so clear, like, it's amazing because I think that you grow up in a DIY world or punk world or whatever, and you think that when you reach a certain point in the music industry that all of a sudden you will be faced with an ethical dilemma and someone will lower the scales and say, choose your ethics or your success. And it gives you this image of people that are trying to cut each other down and, like, everyone's climbing the ladder at the same time, and it's just not true. Because the only thing I've found is, like, the first time I was ever in New York, I got invited out to lunch by one of, like, my favorite musicians. Whenever I've seen, like, I got the... I was so fortunate to play with Torres in Chicago, and I was in the dressing room, and I was like, oh, I'll get out of the way. And she was like, no, this is a shared space. Every single artist I've met that's, like, a female in this industry has been, like, let me send you an email.
There's no catfights.
Because they know how precious it is to have those mental anchors that keep you from spinning off too far in your head or feeling alone or isolated. And it's crazy, this web of musicians that will just check in on you or say, if you're ever in the city and you need anything, or they try to, like, pull you up and support you because there's no success without cooperation. And it just completely dispels that total fallacy that people are trying to not edge you out. You're like, elbow you because your success equals someone else's failure. No, it's just a community of shared success is all I've seen.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich, and here's what it is.
Okay.
It's two of your songs on the outside, and then songs by anybody else you want to play in between.